Hi,
it's Ann
America.
Costello. We have Dr. Alec Miller coming. He's on the phone. Say hi, Alec.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Today is January 28th, 2018, and I'm going to give you the bio of Dr. Miller. He is a clinical psychologist and a teacher and a researcher and an author and a dissemination of evidence that's based treatment in schools, agencies worldwide. He's currently co-founder of the Clinical Director of Cognitive and Behavioral Consultants. It's called CBC, and it's right in White Plains and also in New York City, and as well as a clinical professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. He has many, many books that he's done, and I'm going to read you the titles of some of his books. The DBT with Suicidal Adolescents, DBT Skills Manual for Adolescents, yay, DBT in Schools, and DBT Skills Training for Emotional Problems for Adolescents. In the CBC, which is his cognitive and behavioral consultants, he and his colleagues currently treat patients and train mental health professionals and train schools in CBC and DBT, which is wonderful. And for over 40 schools in the DBT for the schools, he has served for over 20 years, by the way, as a chief of child and adolescent psychology, a director of the Adolescent Depression and Suicide Program, and associate director of psychology, training, and professor of clinical behavior and psychology science at Montefiore.
Thank you, Anne.
Wait, I have a little more. And he's currently serving as a scientific advisor to the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention and, thank you, NEABPD. And he's a member of the Putnam Northern Westchester BOCES Regional Suicide Safety Leadership Team. We're very good to hear that because we have a lot of people from here. And the American Psychological Association. And the fun thing that he is also a board member for Project 375 with Brandon Marshall. Okay,
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks for your nice introduction. It's good to be here, and I want to be able to, you know, meet the needs of the of this audience today. So I'm going to, you know, give a little background in terms of those who are less familiar with specifically with adolescent family DBT work, and then I'll go into some of the skills that we've modified. As many of you probably know, we started adapting DBT for adolescents over 20 years ago and made a lot of modifications to this, adding some skills, but also adding families to the work and adding families to the skills training group, doing a lot of family sessions, adding parenting sessions, and making sure that our caregivers who are in the program get coaching as well. And I'll obviously go over the new skills I just alluded to. You know, while we started adapting this treatment originally the way Marsha Linehan did with individuals who were suicidal and had non-suicidal self-injury and a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder or features, it's clearly over the last, you know, 20 years or so been adapted for a broader audience of youth who have a variety of problems, including mood and anxiety disorders and disruptive behavior disorders and eating disorders, and in addition to BPD. So it really, I guess, wanted to make a case for this transdiagnostic application of DBT and no longer just for individuals with BPD only. You know, again, for many of you, we really believe that we want to do something that's data-based, and we finally have some research data that has shown support for DBT with adolescents. The biosocial theory, I think, as many of you know, is so useful, and we actually spend a great deal of time teaching the biosocial theory to teens and their caregivers together so they can learn about how this theory is relevant and have a better understanding of the emotional dysregulation piece and the emotional vulnerability piece, along with the validation and invalidation that we need to address. And so some of you may know that there's a few studies that have been published, one of which I was involved with in Norway that Lars Mellum was first author on. So I just wanted you guys to know, if you're not familiar with it, that it was published about 3 years ago. Actually, now it's 4 years ago, finding that DBT was statistically significantly better than treatment as usual at the time, which was CBT and psychodynamic in terms of reducing a variety of suicidal and non-suicidal self-injury, depression, hopelessness, and BPD symptoms in under 5 months. And there's some other research that's been coming out of the West Coast, and Tina Goldstein also in Pittsburgh with bipolar youth. So I just want to put a plug in for people to be staying up with the research, because I think if we're going to advocate for recommending this treatment for this population, I want to make sure people know that there are studies to reference. So as many of you know, when we do DBT with teenagers, it's multimodal, similar to the adult program. We have multifamily groups with parents included, caregivers, individual psychotherapy, phone coaching for teens and parents, and family therapy and team. We've been adapting it, as you heard, for schools as well in the last 10 years. And there's really two ways to think about it in schools, just in case you're curious. One is to take the comprehensive model that we've used in outpatient settings and bring it into the school settings, and we teach the schools how to do it for the kids who are showing signs and symptoms and needing help earlier. And then there's the universal prevention approach, which is really exciting, where we're taking DBT skills, which I'm going to review with you in a moment, and giving this to late elementary, middle school, and high school kids who are not showing signs and symptoms, and trying to think of this from a prevention standpoint. And I know, you know, with Perry Hoffman and other folks in NEABPD, we've talked about this notion of primary prevention, and can we even prevent the onset of borderline personality disorder? And it's an empirical question whether or not some of the things that we're doing and teaching these skills early in life as a prophylaxis might be useful. So, you know, in terms of the adolescent work, I want to put a plug in for including caregivers. I mean, as many of you guys know, I know this is near and dear to your hearts. We find that it's so helpful to have family members and particularly parents of teenagers who can model the more effective skill use in a group setting and kind of show them how it's done. Some of the parents and family members may benefit from learning the skills themselves, even if they're skillful in many domains in life. Sometimes with a emotionally dysregulated youth, and as a parent myself, and just interacting with my teenager a few moments ago, I can relate to having to turn to some of my skills in the face of some interesting challenges just a few minutes ago. You know, I think there's some advantages of putting teens and parents in the same group together as a way of some form of exposure for teens and parents to be in some emotion eliciting situations that's therapeutic and quite skills based, where the skills trainers can keep everybody using their skills in real time. And finally, I think the advantages of this multifamily group format is that you also can provide a positive family experience for the teens and parents to come have a bite to eat before or after group, learn skills together, and go home together and reference this as a weekly activity for 24 weeks. And for many of the families that we see, they find this, even though they joke around about how less enthused they are in the beginning and how much this becomes a fixture of their, you know, Wednesday night, shall we say, for many months, and they're going to miss it when it's all over. So I want to ask, are you guys teaching the biosocial theory to when you're having an opportunity to work with the families and putting a plug in for, again, teaching it to the families together when you have the opportunity to do that? All right. So I want to talk about some of the skills modules now and really take some questions as we go. In terms of the orientation module, and teaching the adolescent program, you know, we spend a fair bit of time going over the five problem areas and corresponding skills modules, and every 6 weeks we review that again. And in addition to going over the biosocial theory, in addition to going over the DBT assumptions, in addition to explaining what dialectical means, and a lot of times some of the challenges I think that come up for therapists who are teaching this is dealing with a teen or a parent who says, I've already been through orientation, do I have to come again tonight? You know, why do I need to do this every 6 weeks? And I think the answer is that, first of all, there's advantages of having some repetition over some of the underlying theories, including the biosocial theory, and having it being taught in different ways over time, and understanding the DBT assumptions, and I'm happy to go over those. But I think it's also of value because we have a open group, meaning every 6 weeks we have new folks coming in and every 24 weeks people graduate, to hear asking the senior members in the group, including parents and teens, which of these problem areas relates to them presently and what changes, if any, have happened since they've been here in the terms of problem areas and skills acquisition. And it's really useful, I think, to have the new families hear from the senior families who've been there for 12 or 18 weeks longer, talking about, you know, what changes they've even noticed in the last few months. So I really think there's value, and it's an assessment. What changes, self-assessment, what changes have they noticed? What skills do they still need to work on in the remaining time of skills group? When we talk about these five problem areas, I know Marsha Linehan's original manual talked a lot about, and her revised manual, and problem area number one, this confusion about self, you know, and an identity confusion. With teens and parents, I want to highlight what Jill Rathis and I revised in that problem area, was really talking not only about confusion about self, which is partly developmentally normative for adolescents, but what are we targeting with mindfulness? What we're also targeting is the teenagers' challenges around awareness and mental focus. And a lot of kids will admit, yes, I have trouble maintaining my attentional control and focus where I'm sitting in school or at home, and I'm mentally distracted. And that definitely will be treated with mindfulness and learning mindfulness skills. And the other thing, when you ask a kid who engages in some impulsive behavior or avoidance, what happened? I don't know, I just got upset. A wave of negative emotions came over me. Well, how aware were you of your thoughts and feelings and body sensations early on to notice the onset of your emotional dysregulation? Well, I don't know. I wasn't aware. So mindfulness really is more compelling, and for teenagers, when you tell them we're going to help you with your mental focus and your increased awareness, and we're not ignoring the sense of self and confusion about self, but that isn't the primary sales pitch, if you will, when we're talking to kids and the value of learning mindfulness from a DBT perspective. The other problem areas, as you know, impulsivity, emotional dysregulation, interpersonal problems, and the fifth module that Jill and I developed years ago called Walk in the Middle Path skills to deal with teenager and family challenges. And just so we're clear, what we're teaching in those, and I'm going to go spend some more minutes on that, is teaching dialectical thinking and acting, teaching validation in a more formal way, and teaching learning principles, because many of the families we work with, while they get the theory of learning principles, we want them to be much more vigilant around positive reinforcement and shaping and trying to teach them those learning principles and using extinction as needed, but trying to reduce the overuse of punishment, which we know doesn't teach kids new behavior. It just tells them what we don't want them to do. So we spend a whole module on those Walk in the Middle Path skills, which I'll talk about. And I'm happy, again, if there's any questions as I'm going here, I'm just trying to give a quick overview and then have some time. Anybody want to interject here? Okay.
Yeah, yes, I can just ask.
Sorry?
Right. If I can just ask about the issue of positive reinforcement and staying away from punishment. In family connections, in general, we talk about the parents creating their own limits, which will be necessary to state, perhaps, if it's going to be effective in order to get the children to be able to accept the parents' limits and what they can handle. What the parents oftentimes ask is, okay, but how do we get them to do what we want them to do? And
yes,
in the end of the day, aside from creating a relationship which is positive and which we can use to sort of leverage our positions, and aside from stating our limits and radically accepting if we don't get them met, I wanted to know how you saw sort of punishment or positive reinforcement or shaping fitting into the everything else we're talking about.
So, I think one of the biggest challenges, I think, for a lot of families we work with is how to effectively increase the use of positive reinforcement, and how, what are the exact behaviors that we want to see change and increase, and what are the potential reinforcers that might elicit that behavior. Once they do it, we reinforce them, but sometimes what we think might be reinforcing for one teenager is not. And what we, so I think a lot of it requires some open discussion between the caregivers and their kids as to what would be reinforcing. And you know, we're not going to be giving away the ranch and buying them a new car if they go to school tomorrow, but I do want to think about both, what are the specifics of that? So if you have questions related to that, I think it's very different for each family, but it does require some sit down. While at the same time highlighting what you might have alluded to a moment ago is withholding of privileges that they would otherwise have if they don't do it. So in addition to gaining certain privileges that they want, you're certainly going to withhold them mindfully and carefully in a time-limited way if they don't engage in certain desired behaviors. Some things we learn to ignore and not pay attention to. So you almost want to think of it hierarchically. What are the big-ticket items, the one or two things that we as parents want to address and need to sit down and talk with them about it, that are expectations that we, whether it be attending school, for example, or whatever else the behavior is, and what are the things that we can deal with later? Because there's plenty of fish to fry, and we can't deal with all of them at the same time. Was there
okay,
more that you wanted?
That's very helpful. Okay, we can leave it at that for now.
All right. I'm happy to try to address some specifics as we go here, if we can. When we go, just going through the other modules, in terms of mindfulness skills, things we've added to the mindfulness module in our recent skills manual, we put a whole page in and talking about why bother with mindfulness, and what are the advantages of mindfulness for teenagers, and we give a list of those things and have some discussion to hopefully get some greater commitment to have ongoing mindfulness practice, not only in our weekly skills group, not only maybe in individual sessions, but to essentially be practicing variants of mindfulness throughout the week. And as you guys know, this is mindfulness for everyday life. This isn't necessarily a seated mindfulness practice by themselves for 10 or 15 minutes every day. Well, I'm not against that. I think that's fantastic. If the kids can do it, I want to get them to doing much more daily activities in a mindful fashion, and we give a lot of reasons why. We also have a list of multiple exercises for teenagers that people can reference and a mindfulness cheat sheet in the mindfulness manual. In distress tolerance skills, you guys probably are all familiar with the TIP skills and, tipping the temperature, increasing exercise, paced breathing, and progressive muscle relaxation. And I really want to put a plug in to have the kids and the families practice these skills in group. And we run through, several of them where they get some experiential practice as well as assigning it for homework. But I think for the skills group leaders where you can get everyone to practice in group together, have ice packs and do paced breathing, demonstrating the differences of when you do normal breathing. And most people in the room say, yeah, I just had about 15 or 20 in and out breaths in 1 minute. And then now let's try it again with a longer exhalation and hopefully get to about 5 in and out breaths in a minute and notice the incredible improvement in their breathing and calming of their nervous system. And we do a whole progressive muscle relaxation exercise as well. I do want to put a plug in for the crisis survival toolkits that we advise teens and families to work on. So when we teach distract with accepts and self-soothe, we have the six senses, including movement, improve the moment, pros and cons, tip skills I just mentioned. You go through all those, and then part of the homework assignment is to put together a toolkit that can be used in the classroom, at home, and certainly some family members will put a toolkit together that can be parents can be done at work. And we do a show and tell. So they put these kits together and they bring things in. And that ranges from, you know, various photographs, various sucking candies, various squeeze toys, various Sudoku puzzles, obviously some music. And I want people to be willing to share it. But more importantly, I want to see that they have things at the ready. And it's all well and good to talk in theory, like, yeah, if I got distressed, I would use this someday, versus I have this little box that can be opened up, and I have a host of things that I can use at home, in my bedroom, or in school. And we work a lot with schools, as you heard mentioned, where we want the schools to understand that these kids are working on a variety of skills, and instead of having the kids getting pulled out and going into the assistant principal's office for the entire day as a quote-unquote calming or punishment situation, I'd much rather have the teacher gently nudge the teenager in the classroom and say, hey, why don't you go into your desk right here and grab something, and subtly or not so subtly, and have the youth maybe doing some coloring or some puzzles or something, and mindfully distracting instead of running out of the classroom. And we've had some great success once the network has been oriented to this as a game plan. So where the schools are willing to work with us, even if we're outside consultants, or you guys can speak to the guidance or assistant principal and get some permission to have the teacher consider this, I think it's very, very useful. Another question that comes up, you know, from teens and parents when we're teaching distress tolerance skills is, well, these skills didn't make me feel better. And the answer is, this is correct. We're not trying to teach you distress tolerance to necessarily feel better. We're trying to have you use these skills to prevent you from feeling and doing worse things. So it's like a tourniquet. You know, you put a tourniquet on if you have an open wound on your arm, it doesn't feel good, but it's going to hopefully keep you from, you know, worse outcomes. And so I want to kind of distinguish distress tolerance skills from emotion regulation skills, which are intended to do, you know, for example, pleasant activities where we're trying to change our emotions in the positive direction and quote unquote feel better and put more pennies in the emotional piggy bank. This is just to stop the feeling worse and deteriorating that way. I tell the kids and the parents they may need to put 3 or 4 or 5 of these crisis survival skills together. So you might need to go through your box of a handful of things over the course of 15, 20 minutes, a half hour, 2 hours, and see if you can string these together if one loses its power and effectiveness. So I wanted to put a couple of points in about that. Are there questions about teaching distress tolerance skills specifically?
I'm just going to improve as part of the distress tolerance skills. Isn't that making things feel better in the moment?
Well, improve, you know, by the acronym, it sounds that way. It's certainly trying to use imagery and relaxation and, you know, vacation and meaning. And in a sense, if you want to extend it, yeah, I want to kind of find meaning in some very painful things. Again, I guess I don't want people to set themselves up to think, you know, because I found meaning in this, I automatically feel good. I just hopefully, you know, like I'm not feeling good from doing this. And I guess that's really the contrast. Yeah, could you find meaning in that and purpose in life or meaning about some tragic thing that happened? Yes. But as you can imagine, depending on what it is, it doesn't necessarily lead to great joy and exuberance as much as it is stopping the, you know, decompensation or emotional unraveling. And that's really what I'm thinking of crisis survival skills, even including improve. It's almost like putting the brake on it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Other questions about distress tolerance skills or challenges in teaching those skills?
Well, it's Anne. I want to make sure these all come from your DBT Skills Manual for Adolescents, that book that
That's
you and
right.
Jill did. Yeah,
that's right.
We use your book all the time when we do DBT. So if people can purchase that, it's you can go on to Amazon. It's called DBT Skills Manual for Adolescents.
All right, thanks, Anne.
Okay.
Any other questions about distress tolerance before I move on to the mental path skills?
Just a quick comment that I think it's really helpful for me. It was very clarifying when you said it's not to make things better. But, you know, think about the tourniquet stopping the bleeding. We stopped.
Yeah.
We haven't made it worse. We stopped
that's
the
right.
worsening process. And that's an important thing to hold on to, I think.
That's right. Thanks, Matt. So in terms of the mental path skills, you know, we really have, made some modifications for adolescents and families, which was, I think, a bigger contribution in this regard, in the sense that we really noticed families getting polarized and these repeating themes and some of the individual family members, teens and caregivers swinging from extremes and not being able to see one another's perspectives effectively. And then sometimes, as I alluded to, relying on ineffective means of trying to get their family members to change. And so because of those things that we observed over time, we added these, you know, we saw these dialectical dilemmas, which I'm going to mention to you, and we wanted to really talk about how do you get unstuck and, you know, get on, you know, kind of on opposite sides of the Grand Canyon, and how do you see multiple truths? You know, in the last month, I could argue that snow was the bane of my, snow and ice was the bane of my existence, trying to get down my frozen driveway without, you know, with my car or not, you know, not slipping, walking the dog and just freezing my tush off. And at the same time, I could argue snow is just a beautiful, these crystals that are each one so individual and unique and two sides of the same coin. I could argue the cell phone that I'm talking to you through now is amazing, amazing technology that I can be anywhere in the world and just have this conversation with this group of people on these smartphones. And at the same time, having teenagers, my kids who are teenagers, also feel like it can be completely occupying to them and for my wife and I, too, to be mindful of how intrusive, you know, the phones can be, you know, and being careful that, you know, that these are really hijacking our society. And so, you know, both are true. It's amazing and it's terrible. And how do we find a middle path on some of the following dilemmas I'm going to mention to you between being too loose on the one hand as caregivers and too strict on the other? How do you find the middle path between making light of problem behaviors that our teenagers are engaging in without, you know, making too much of typical teenage behaviors? And then, of course, holding on too tight on the one hand, and I think in some ways doing everything for our kids and fostering dependence, and then sometimes swinging to forcing independence too soon and kind of conveying that they got to take care of the things on their own. So these were some of the some very prominent dilemmas that we observed in the teens and families we worked with, and we really wanted to talk about how, you know, teaching dialectics and how to use it and being mindful of our language and getting away from the either or kind of language, right or wrong, good or bad, smart or stupid, and moving much more toward both both and both and thinking. I see the kernels of truth in your perspective and see the kernels of truth in this perspective, and really trying to honor and look for, and with great, you know, determination, the kernels of truth in the other's perspective, even when you don't seem at first blush to have any clue how that makes sense. And I want to make a point here. You don't want to validate the invalid, and you don't want to validate things you don't understand, right? But I do want to kind of try to see what's being left out of my understanding, and curious minds want to know. So, my mom is really strict, and she cares a lot. You know, I'm working to accept your situation, and I also think it's worth figuring out how we can, you know, how I can accept my situation and figure out how to change it. I can be both serious as I'm teaching this to you right now, and I can be silly and playful at the same time. So really teaching teens and caregivers to adopt a more dialectical way of thinking about things. And, you know, recognizing, you know, what one of the cognitive therapy strategies we teach in DBT are these helping to identify cognitive distortions or thinking mistakes. And as Ann and Matt know, when we teach these skills, we talk about all or nothing thinking, mental filter, should statements. These are from Aaron Beck's and Judy Beck's cognitive distortions list that we've added to our middle path module, because undoubtedly when you use language like always, never, completely, you know, that's going to foster an extreme way of thinking about things and therefore have more extreme emotional and behavioral responses. So we really want to help the teens and parents be able to review this list of thinking mistakes, if you will, that are universal. I make them. I share examples. But I think over time I've gotten better at catching them before they magnify and mushroom my own emotional and behavioral responses, because I can see them for what they are. You know, there I go jumping to conclusions again, or there I go with my catastrophic thinking. I know that's not accurate. And so it doesn't help, though, for parents to say, oh, there you go with your catastrophic thinking again. You want to be careful not to be telling others how they are engaging in this distorted thinking, but you certainly want to be aware of it yourself and have people learn it so they can be more self-monitoring, and then maybe their individual therapists can work with them on that. Let me just see. Are there questions specifically about the dilemmas? I do, when I have families, by the way, in my group, try to have them do what we call family sculptures, where we have a teenager position along the long wall. If one side was too loose and the other was too strict, trying to position where they think, if they had two parents in the room, where would they position, or how do they view each of their caregivers as it relates to them? And how do they rate themselves in terms of, are they a little too lenient or too harsh on themselves on an average? You know, there's variability based on certain things that happen day to day. But family sculptures are very interesting, because then I have each caregiver position, let's say the three family members, however they see it on each of these dilemmas. And it's kind of illuminating, and they do it in front of these other families. And it's not that we resolve, you know, the dilemma and figure out how are we going to all find this middle path in this one moment, but at least it gives some data, and it's kind of an interesting little fun assessment, you know, that can be useful in family sessions that follow. So I do want to, and I can talk more about that if people are interested. One of the handouts that we developed for the manual is called What's Typical for Adolescents and What's Not. And if you're familiar with that, I think it's worth also having some discussion among teens and parents based on, you know, the epidemiological research, right? You know, it's typical for there to be increased parent-teen conflict among adolescents, that, you know, on the one hand. And what's not typical and what's cause for concern is verbal or physical aggression, running away, and avoidance on all communication. You know, it's typical to engage in some sexual experimentation as you get older, and it's not typical and cause for concern to have multiple partners, unsafe sex practices, and so on. So, you know, it's typical to have a messy room, but it's not typical to have old rotting food and can't find basic necessities in your room. So there's a long list that we based on research that I think, you know, is eye-opening, because some of the families who we work with sometimes over time get a little desensitized to things, and when they say, yeah, that actually is concerning, and I guess I haven't been paying enough attention to that. And for some teenagers, they think, oh, it's just my parents are overreacting. And when they see it in black and white, they realize that others have objectively determined that some of what they're doing is cause for concern and not typical. And that also lends itself to some, I think, useful discussion among families. Have you guys spent any time reviewing that and going over that with teens and families together?
What you're talking about is funny. That's the question I wrote down, which is how do you sift between the normative and not adolescence? And I forgot that that typical versus non-typical handout is there because, you know, adolescence is so tumultuous. And
yeah.
I think parents can get lulled saying, well, that's, you know, all kids do that. And then all kids don't do that. And
right.
It's a tricky one to navigate, certainly for parents, but I guess also for clinicians too.
You're right, Matt. I think, and the other factors that make it even more challenging is even within adolescence, you know, there are differences between what's typical for a 12-year-old versus a 17-and-a-half-year-old. There's variations on family values that may influence what's acceptable. You know, some have zero tolerance. If they found out a kid, you know, tried to do something either sexually or had a sip of beer, and others, you know, are more tolerant and see that. So there's family values influences. There's even within adolescence the developmental differences, and we don't want to interfere in the family's values. And yet at the same time, trying to give some compass of what is kind of and feedback as to what is under the broad umbrella of typical versus cause for concern. So I think it is hard even for clinicians sometimes, but certainly for families too, to figure out, to tease that out over time. And so I think we've gotten a lot of positive feedback actually about that handout being very useful when we talk about some of these things. It's a couple of pages long.
Great. Thank you.
When we did some research, just out of, might find this interesting, we did a study on what of the 33 skills that we teach, you know, the Linehanian skills coupled with, you know, middle path skills and others, what do they find most helpful? Well, first of all, the research showed that it was very highly acceptable that the teens and parents found the middle path skills helpful. They ranked this module most helpful among all the modules, and specifically validation was considered the most beneficial skill to parents and teenagers among all DBT skills, with positive reinforcement close behind. So I just wanted to mention that, of the research. And we published that study in the American Journal of Psychotherapy a few years ago. So I wanted to mention that. Again, there's more I can talk about with middle path, but I think we've also added some new skills in emotion regulation, interpersonal, that I want to make sure I highlight. In the emotion regulation module, you know, we updated our model of emotions that, you know, is similar to Marcia Linehan's version in the adult manual, and we also added the skills that correspond to the model of emotions, right? So, you know, whether it be please skills as it relates to reducing vulnerability factors, or whether it be opposite action, you know, to current emotion when it comes to dealing with changing emotions and so on. So there's some worksheets that have some, I think, useful, more detailed pairing of both the skills from emotion regulation and the model of emotions, and to better understand that and to unpack that. So I think the kids and caregivers find that useful to kind of spend a fair bit of time on that. We've also, in terms of, we added some more primary emotions for teens and families to look at, including love and jealousy. And we also spent some time differentiating what's the difference between primary and secondary emotions. And I think for families that we work with, they find it useful to understand that, understandably, they have they come across sometimes to teenagers as looking frustrated, irritated, and angry. But when I ask, when I talk about what's primary and secondary and I explain the difference, what is common is that many of these parents are feeling anxious or sad or feeling some sense of either guilt, but those are not the emotions they're expressing. And for a lot of the families we work with, when they can get in touch with their anxiety and fear that's really driving some of their expressed emotion, the kids can hear that so much better than the angry expression that's coming across sometimes. And so we unpack that primary and secondary emotions and right in front of the whole multifamily group and try to have them be more mindful of it and target that primary emotion. And that's for kids too, of course. We also added, in terms of other skills for changing emotional responses, we added the skills of checking the facts and problem solving, which is also out of Marsha's newer work. And we reorganized and expanded the skills for reducing emotional vulnerability. So you guys know the ABC please skills. We added a few things there. So we added optional food and mood, and helping them see how their eating affects their mood. And we also developed a whole sleep hygiene protocol. And I got to tell you guys, I'm sure you're aware of this, but the teenagers that we have been working with have for years had quite impaired sleep. And when I first started working with teenagers, you know, doing DBT 20-something years ago, I used to think of sleep impairment as a lower target. You know, I got to work on their suicidality, their self-injury, you know, depressed mood, their eating disordered behavior. And then after doing some research, I realized I had a little bit backwards and that I was not aggressively tracking their sleep, what time they go to bed and what time they wake up, not aggressively treating their sleep impairment, because the research that came out of Montefiore, my staff several years ago, found that kids who had either initial insomnia, middle insomnia, or what we call terminal insomnia, waking up early, any of those had differential effects on increases in suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, non-suicidal self-injury. And there hasn't been a lot of research on this, so I just want to make sure you guys know about this. And not to mention that when you have that sleep impairment, it can affect one's moods and be more prone to depressive and manic episodes. And so it's critical that we more aggressively treat sleep impairment. And so I really want to put a plug in for all of you working with teens and families to make sure that we're doing our best to deal with sleep impairment and on a behavioral level, work on sleep hygiene and teaching them how to improve all the steps behaviorally to get better sleep. And there's a whole, you know, 13 different pointers there. But pharmacologically, too, if that's not working and we work aggressively on that pharmacologically, treating that more aggressively. And all the sleep experts say that a lot of psychiatrists and doctors are worried about giving sleep medicine for too long. And so they just give it and families just take it as needed. But then they don't really treat the insomnia. And as you all know, screens are one of the bigger culprits that get in the way. And so I, with my own kids, make sure that their screens are downstairs in the kitchen overnight. So when they go to bed, they're not tempted to be checking it or functioning as a mobile crisis team to their peer groups in the middle of the night when somebody's having some difficulty. So I really want to put a plug in for that.
Yeah, and I would love to plug in. Also, we have two children who have borderline personality disorder, and they have been having sleep disorders. And before we knew that they had borderline, we thought it was just us. And then when we learned all about borderline and DBT, and when we do our family connections, we find that I would say about 80% of the family members, their children have sleep disorders.
Yeah. Undiagnosed and untreated, you mean, or?
Yeah, and they tried to get, I mean, my son had to take pills in order because he had a job. Yay, he had a job.
and he had
to get up early. And he was able to work on it, but he did have to take a lot of sleeping pills, which was not good either. Yeah.
Right. Well, we don't want them to get addicted and dependent on it either.
Yeah,
I know.
Right.
So that's,
yeah,
that's the dialectical tension as you're highlighting. I agree.
Yeah.
Another thing that we've added to the emotion regulation module is a parent-teen shared pleasant activity list. So, as you all know, when we treat depressed individuals or individuals with BPD, everyone, basically, we want to increase pleasurable activities because we know there's a direct correlation between more pleasurable activities in your day also often correlates with a higher mood. But what we realized was we were doing a lot of it individually, and we wanted to kind of prescribe some homework, if you will, that involved teens and parents doing pleasant activities, because as you all know, that kind of atrophies when there's conflict and depression and emotion dysregulation and BPD. It's harder and harder to do it. So we want to make that as a homework assignment and have people schedule that, which then will make it easier once they get over the hump and back into some shared pleasurable time together. The other thing we added for adolescents was trying to help with long-term goals. Someone asked a question earlier about motivation, and sometimes, why do you change behavior in the short term? Well, it often has implications for long term, and we want to help the kids who are 15, 16, 17, 13. What are your values and priorities? And maybe we can get you to do some things that are consistent with that. And without having awareness of your values and priorities, I think it's very hard for many of us to get ourselves to do things we don't want to do. And so I refer you to that emotion regulation handout that we put together that I think has a lot to do with helping teens work on long-term goals. And I think that might help get some kids over the hump, because maintaining games is so critical to having long-term goals in mind and priorities in mind. So that is something that we added to this version of our manual. And lastly, I wanted to mention a new skill that we developed in the interpersonal effectiveness skills called the Think Skills. And this is from Crickin Dodge's social emotional processing research. And the Think Skills are all about perspective taking and benign interpretations, which I think in some ways overlaps with some mentalization work that many of you might be familiar with and Bateman and Fonagy's work. We didn't extract it directly from there, but it actually think I had in terms of perspective taking, trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes, and that's so thinking about others' view is T. H is have empathy. I is interpretations for others' behaviors. N is to notice ways the other person's been trying or struggling. And K is for kindness, and really kind of working on that piece of things to deal with certain family conflicts as well, in addition to the give and dear man and fast skills. And we do a lot of role plays of different family compositions. So I try to find, if I have five families in there, I mix and match the family members so they're not with each other, their own families, and work on these skills, role playing with each other to get some practice again in session in group. So there's more I can say, but I'm mindful of our time, and I apologize, I was a few minutes late. So please feel free to ask some questions and see what I can clarify for you. Anybody have some questions for me?
I do. I was just trying to be polite, let room for other people.
Okay.
I think early on you mentioned transdiagnostic applications. We have a lot of people, especially if they're coming at the younger end, where they come with a diagnosis, if they have one at all, of bipolar. And people can sometimes fixate on, well, they say they're bipolar, not borderline. And so, and we sometimes take the attitude is it's the behaviors we're looking at and perhaps ways the skills can help. Have you found, though, looking at someone who is diagnosed, is transdiagnostic mean that the skills have been shown to be effective more across a broad spectrum of diagnoses?
Yes. So the answer is yes. I think these skills have been shown to be effective across diagnoses, including bipolar. Tina Goldstein, if anybody wants to, look her up and her research with bipolar adolescents, I think the skills are the same. The issue is how to, if they're frankly have true blue bipolar disorder and it's not yet well managed pharmacologically, then they're, actively manic or hypomanic, it's very hard if with a full-blown episode like that to have them in a skills group. That you might do single family skills training The way she's done it in her research at Pittsburgh is have weekly individual sessions alternating with single family skills so that it would be less disruptive to other group members. However, I've had plenty of kids who have better managed bipolar illness attend my multifamily groups and do just fine. But certainly the research is looks very promising for bipolar adolescents with DBT. And Matt, did I answer that in terms of transdiagnostically, or do you want me to talk more about that?
And the great thing is that's a, you know, what you've said, as much as I took notes, is passing on, because everybody in the call pretty much are leaders, but I mean, you know, other people here too, but passing that information on to parents who come in, perhaps overly concerned about diagnosis, and we, that data sort of says, you know, here's evidence that these skills help.
That's right.
Even if you're on a line between bipolar and borderline or...
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I like your answer, how you address that. I'm more focusing on behaviors and impairment of functioning and not just focusing on the actual name or label of the specific diagnosis. Because many of the youth we see are multi-problem or multi-diagnostic anyway. So, yeah. Other
Hi, Alec.
Yes.
Sorry, it's Marie-Paul. How are you?
Hi, Marie-Paul. How are you?
Good, thank you. I have another transdiagnostic question. I'm finding that it's clearer to distinguish between bipolar and borderline. What I'm finding a little bit more difficult is the vast number of adolescents who come across as, you know, anxious, depressed, school refusal, and then contagion via social media in terms of self-harm. So, you know, there's this, like, pervasive misery that is more sort of implosive than explosive. We don't really see the extreme anger, but it's very paralyzing anyway.
Yes.
What are your observations about that?
Yeah, no, I think these are good questions and some seemingly more 21st century pervasiveness, if you will. I do feel like those more internalizing kids, implosive and less externalizing, can be, as you're highlighting, just as impairing. I do think DBT is well-suited for those problems as well. I think the key, though, is we have to have a tri-pronged approach. So not only is the individual work and the family work critical, but absolutely critical is being on the same page with the school and having active communication with them. But I think a lot of behavioral work around the school refusing, and everyone has to be on the same page. So I think the treatment is fine. I think it's just you have to be a lot more working systemically to address some of those things. But avoidance, a lot of these kids may be avoiding because of anxiety and not knowing how to manage that, and we have to treat anxiety more aggressively. And frankly, DBT is weakest when it comes to just treating pure anxiety disorders. That is not its strongest suit. But, you know, you have to add some other pieces to help with anxiety. But certainly distress tolerance skills can be useful for getting back to school. But it's the behavioral piece that I think can sometimes be missing if we're working too much in more traditional outpatient settings without working with the school and the parents. Because there may be too much access to reinforcing things at home, you know, whether it be screens or social media, where they're on all day when they're not going to school, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Thanks.
Sure.
Any other questions? Going once, twice, three times? I tell you should get his book, DBT Skills Manual for Adolescents, with Alec Miller and Jill Rathus. They both can do it. It's wonderful. It's very helpful. And we use a lot of your things that you have there, which are wonderful, and we're very happy to have that. And thank you so much for coming. And our next class, our next group that we're going to have is with Karen Hall, who's going to do early BPD identification. So that'll
That's
be
great.
In, yeah, and that's
well,
in March, by the way, March 18th.
Thanks,
okay,
Anna,
thank
Matt,
you.
For inviting me. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a good week.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
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 Thank you.